From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, trying to bring to justice the perpetrators of genocide, mass rape, ethnic cleansing, and other atrocities. We talk with Justice Richard Goldstone, the former chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. He's currently serving on the Constitutional Court of his own country, South Africa, helping it make the transition from apartheid to democracy. Also, Leah Rabin discusses the assassination of her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, the former prime minister of Israel, and the impact it's had on her life and the life of her country as the peace process her husband moved forward unravels. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Clinton administration is urging Zaire's President Mobutu Sese Seko to leave power and go into exile. Press Secretary Mike McCurry says Mobutu should also accept a transitional government in his country. A 7-month-long civil war has spread to Zaire's second-largest city, Lubumbashi. Police in Zaire's capital, Kinshasa, broke up protest marches today as Mobutu fired his new prime minister and then replaced him with the Zairean Army Chief of Staff. About 24 Palestinians have been wounded in new clashes with Israeli forces in the West Bank town of Hebron. The violence resumed after the funeral of one of three Palestinians killed in confrontations yesterday between Palestinians and Israeli troops and settlers. Lori Neff reports.
The new clashes erupted after thousands of Palestinians attending the funeral chanted slogans calling for revenge and suicide attacks against Israel. Then crowds gathered near Israeli troops guarding some 400 Jewish settlers in the mainly Arab city and threw rocks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails. The Israeli forces responded with rubber-coated metal bullets. The Palestinian buried was one of two Arabs shot by Israeli forces during demonstrations yesterday. The riots broke out after a Palestinian was shot by a Jewish religious student in a part of Hebron still under Israeli control. There have been almost daily Israeli-Palestinian clashes since Israel broke ground last month on a controversial Jewish settlement in traditionally Arab East Jerusalem. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Jerusalem.
Flooding continues to inundate the Upper Plains. Swollen rivers are well above flood stage in the Dakotas and Minnesota. Sandbagging continues along the Minnesota River. Residents fear that flood crests they battled earlier this year they'll have to fight all over again when ice and snow from last weekend's blizzard start to melt. Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon has been elected to a second term. He easily defeated challenger, State Senator Tom Hayden, by a margin of 63% to 33%. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
As his supporters shouted, "Four more years," Richard Reardon said, "Together we have turned Los Angeles around. We've restored confidence in our city. We've made our city safer. We rebuilt our economy." He said in his second term he wanted to increase the number of quality jobs in the city and improve education. During the campaign, State Senator Tom Hayden accused Reardon of abandoning the inner city in favor of downtown business interests. Last night, Hayden thanked his supporters for, quote, "trying to visualize and dream a dream of a livable L.A." Despite Reardon's easy victory, his candidate for city attorney was soundly defeated. But a referendum supported by the mayor was adopted by the voters. As a result, a commission will be formed to rewrite the city's charter or constitution. Reardon funded that measure with about $500,000 of his own money. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 13 points at 6,595. The stock market is mixed today. We have more from Bloomberg's Doug Krisner in New York.
The most active issue is Merck & Company, which has lost 5%. Investors are concerned that Merck's best-selling drugs are losing market share to Warner Lambert's rival medications. On the other hand, Procter & Gamble has rallied on news the company is buying Tambrands, the maker of Tampax, for $2 billion. A number of the day's earnings reports have been better than expected. Seagate Technologies, Abbott Laboratories, and Best Buy Company each beat forecast for first-quarter profit. However, shares in Chrysler are lower, after the company said it will invest more than $1.3 billion to boost production of its Jeep Grand Cherokee and light truck engines. I'm Doug Krisner.
A published report says the Federal Trade Commission is opening a campaign to stop fraudulent phone solicitors who try to raise money for local police and fire departments. USA Today reports the FTC will announce an effort involving dozens of lawsuits and a public awareness campaign. Consumer protection officials say people should ask phone solicitors who call to send them written information and then double-check on the organization. Members of the United Auto Workers continue their strike against General Motors in Oklahoma City. About 3,500 workers left their jobs last Friday. Negotiators from both sides have been meeting ever since. Union officials say their primary concern is plant safety. This is the first strike in 18 years at the Oklahoma City plant. It produces the Chevy Malibu and the Oldsmobile Cutlass. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, sponsoring a compelling dialogue, Before I Die, Medical Care and Personal Choices, on many PBS stations April 22nd.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Beacon Press, publisher of Questions of Heaven, The Chinese Journeys of an American Buddhist by Gretel Ehrlich. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Justice Richard Goldstone has been investigating some of the worst behavior in the human repertoire. He was the first chief prosecutor for the International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, trying to bring to justice the people responsible for genocide, mass rape, ethnic cleansing, and other atrocities. Justice Goldstone is also trying to help his own country, South Africa, in its transition from apartheid to democracy. He now serves on South Africa's Constitutional Court, which interprets the new constitution. From 1991 to 94, he investigated human rights abuses under apartheid as chairperson of the Commission of Inquiry regarding Public Violence and Intimidation, which became known as the Goldstone Commission. He's visiting the U.S., and tomorrow evening will speak at a conference on genocide and war at the University of California at Berkeley. While he headed the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, it indicted two of the war's leaders, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic and General Ratko Mladic, but they have not yet been apprehended. I asked what Justice Goldstone thinks is standing in the way.
Well, a lack of political will in the West particularly, and obviously the United States, as a leading Western nation, is most culpable in that regard, in my opinion. The United States, other Western powers, Great Britain and France in particular, supported the establishment of the War Crimes Tribunal. It's the international community's body, and it was authorized to indict and issue warrants of arrest in the name of the United Nations Security Council, acting on behalf of the whole international community. But there's been no political will to follow through and ensure that the people indicted in their name have been apprehended.
You were met with a lot of frustrations in the Yugoslavia International War Crimes Tribunal, and the Rwanda War Crimes Tribunal has been criticized by the UN for mismanagement, for chaos, for underqualified staff, financial abuses. I'm wondering, from your perspective of having overseen two of these war crimes tribunals, do you think that they can work? You've met with frustration on each of them. What do you think we can really hope to accomplish with them, and what do you think is going to be impossible?
Well, I have no doubt that if efficient administration is provided by the international community, in this case by the United Nations, those problems can be overcome. I mean, the sort of problems were administrative, bureaucratic, and had nothing to do with the principle or the concept or the philosophy of having an international war crimes tribunal. So I don't think any rational or any relevant or sensible conclusions, negative or positive, should be drawn from those problems on the one hand, and the ability of an international war crimes tribunal to work on the other.
I wonder what the impact has been like on you personally, sitting through testimony of rape and atrocities and genocide. Does it start to become more predictable and less shocking as you hear more and more of it?
Well, I hope not. I think the important thing to do, and this is one of the benefits of trials, is to personalize the human rights violations, the terrible things which have happened. Statistics really don't get to people's hearts, or in fact even to their minds. To say that 20,000 women have been raped, as horrible as it sounds, has less impact than hearing the testimony of one of those women who speaks with her own voice and tells people what happened to her.
Just another question about the war crimes tribunals of today. These are the first war crimes tribunals since the Nuremberg trials.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between what prosecutors faced in the Nuremberg trials and what the people on today's war crime tribunals face?
Right. Well, there are a number of fundamental differences. The one is at Nuremberg, there was no international prosecutor's office. Each of the four victorious powers, the main victorious powers, had their own offices. So Justice Jackson only worked with American prosecutors, with American military police and so forth. In The Hague and in Arusha, we have a truly international prosecutor's office. The one in The Hague, there were representatives from about 40 different countries. But importantly, at Nuremberg, there was a very efficient paper trail that the Nazis left behind. If one looks at the Nuremberg record, one's impressed with the huge amount of documentary evidence that the prosecutors relied on, and the relative paucity of oral evidence, of actual witnesses, eyewitnesses. In The Hague and in Arusha for Rwanda, it's the converse. Hardly any documentary evidence and a huge reliance on witnesses. And that's, in my view, incidentally, is probably a positive thing. I'd much rather have eyewitnesses for the reasons we talked about earlier, rather than cold documents, cold print, which really don't make an impression on the public, and particularly on victims.
We seem to be heading in two directions now in terms of dealing with war criminals and dictators and crimes inside a country. On the one hand, there's the International War Crime Tribunals in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia. On the other hand, we have truth commissions that have been established in several countries,
right,
including in your country, South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And with the truth commission, the understanding is that the job is to find out what really happened and that amnesty will be given to people who come forward and actually tell the truth, and that the truth is somehow more important than punishing the perpetrators. And I'm wondering what you think of the truth commission approach to dealing with crimes.
Well, I think it's difficult to generalize. In South Africa, I've been a very firm and vocal supporter of the truth commission. There was a political necessity, or there was the truth commission in South Africa was a result of a political compromise. The old leaders, the de Klerk government, for obvious reasons, wanted to forget about the past, get on with the future, and simply have amnesia. The African National Congress and other liberation organizations wanted Nuremberg-style trials. The compromise was a truth commission where the truth would, it was hoped, and that hope has been realized, that the truth would come out in return for amnesties. What I would stress is that, in my view, the moral underpinning for the decision to have a truth commission was that it was agreed to by the first ever democratically elected parliament of South Africa, a parliament which the majority of delegates to that parliament, the majority of representatives, in fact were elected by the victims of apartheid. It was important, obviously, that the de Klerk government, as part of the compromise, also approved of that decision. So you had an overwhelming majority of South Africans in favor of it. And I think that's very important. It wasn't a question of the perpetrators deciding themselves to grant themselves indemnities for the truth. It was a decision taken really by representatives of all groups in the country.
You're on the Constitutional Court now in South Africa. Tell us a few of the things that you think make the new constitution special in South Africa.
Well, a number of things. Firstly, it's, I think, generally, according to foreign commentators, it's the most modern and probably one of the best constitutions. It has a very extensive Bill of Rights, which is really at the heart of it. I'm sitting with 10 other colleagues who others during my absence have already started laying the foundations of a new constitutional jurisprudence in South Africa. Fortunately, it also has the full support of the majority of South Africans. So really, all of these things make it very special.
I bet you never thought you'd be doing this when you became a judge.
No, absolutely not.
Or when you studied law.
Right.
In fact, it's interesting, you know, studying law in South Africa. South Africa was a place where the law upheld injustices. I mean, the law upheld apartheid and many of its abuses. So how did you feel when you were a judge, knowing that you were entering a system that was upholding injustice?
Well, what was important was that South African judges had a real independence, life appointment, irremovable, save for dishonesty or incompetence, and then only by impeachment proceedings in the parliament. So I knew I was, even under the apartheid system, I would have independence. Importantly, since 1979, there was a particular Legal Resources Center, which was a public interest law firm set up initially in consequence of very important United States support, financial and legal. And it was using the courts to find loopholes, to find gaps in the apartheid laws. And it was very important, I had no doubt, and that proved to be so, that judges who opposed racial discrimination and racial oppression should become involved and, as it were, do what they could. And many South African judges, or a substantial number of South African judges, certainly eased the situation of many millions of black South Africans, and I have no doubt contributed to the peaceful change that has, or comparatively peaceful change that has occurred.
One of the things you did was in 1982, you gutted the Group Areas Act and made it illegal for the courts to evict people from their homes and transfer them to townships, which had been legal before.
Right.
So was that a difficult decision for you, or a difficult job to do?
No, it wasn't. It was really seeing that the law had been incorrectly applied for over 30 years. Judges in lower courts who had been given a discretion didn't exercise that discretion and automatically evicted people who were found guilty of living in the wrong group area. And that obviously in all cases meant that blacks were living illegally in areas that had been designated only for white occupation. And it was one judgment in one particular case. And I'd love to claim that I anticipated that it would have the snowball effect that it did have. I didn't. It seemed to be the right thing to do in that case, but in the result, it was the last time that anybody was prosecuted under that legislation, and that led to previous white areas becoming non-racial.
Because of the Truth Commission, now people are coming forward in South Africa and confessing to things that they did with the understanding that they'll get amnesty for it.
Right.
How are those people being treated in the larger society now? They're not going to be imprisoned for what they did, but are they being shunned, or are they still holding high-level positions?
Well, firstly, let me say that they could still be imprisoned if they don't get the indemnity. It's not automatic. There are certain criteria that have to be met to get an indemnity. One is proportionality. There has to be a proportionality between the political motive and the political end on the one hand and the human rights violations on the other. But on the assumption that they get indemnity, it's correct that they will not be prosecuted, they will not be punished. But clearly they are being seen for what they were by the general community. They'll certainly, I've no doubt, be unfit for any public office, for any position in the security forces or in other government body. No doubt in their own little circles, they may even be regarded as heroes, but certainly in the national community, they will be shunned as people who have committed some of the worst human rights violations that one can imagine.
I wonder if you think that people are capable of change, that people who once committed war crimes or human rights abuses in their country are capable of reforming.
Well, I think that's happening already in South Africa. I think possibly one of the greatest victories has been the difficulty now of finding many people who supported apartheid. Everybody all of a sudden was against it, was doing what they could to avoid it. You even have the former commissioner of police who has now admitted, who has now applied for indemnity for blowing up a building that was occupied by a trade union. He's applied for indemnity for covering up the murder by his own security police liberation, members of the liberation groups. Even he is now heading a human rights organization to protect the rights of people he worked with in the police. So there's sort of been an instant conversion to relying on to using the Constitution and relying on it. As ironic as that is, and even though it might stick in the throats of many people, it's an indication of how a human rights culture is beginning to build up in our country.
But I wonder if you think that that's somebody just kind of covering their behinds and trying to look good.
Of course they are, but I don't think that matters. I don't think it's happening, and I think that's the important thing for the future.
What kinds of issues are you examining now in the Constitutional Court?
Well, really everything across the whole spectrum. Some of the most high-profile case was the first case the court heard, and that was the constitutionality of the death sentence when the court unanimously found it to be unconstitutional. There are quality cases, too, we've been involved with, where the opinion should be made public in the next week to 10 days, dealing with gender and sex equality, dealing with equality in the criminal and civil justice system. The abortion issue is likely to come very soon, later this year, before the Constitutional Court, because a new statute in South Africa has made abortion much easier, virtually on demand. So I think many of the issues, affirmative action is going to come before the court. Many of the issues that have come before the United States Supreme Court have already been coming, and that trend will continue.
Justice Richard Goldstone serves on South Africa's Constitutional Court. Tomorrow evening, he speaks at a conference on genocide and war at the University of California at Berkeley. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week for public radio, so we need to take a break here to remind you that it's time to make a pledge. Public radio isn't supported by mandatory fees, but there is a steep price if listeners don't support it. The station would just go off the air. You've come to rely on us for news, conversation, entertainment. Keep it coming by making a pledge. Thank you. Producer, singer, and songwriter Lee Scratch Perry is a cult figure in reggae music. In the late 60s and early 70s, Perry produced many numbers with Bob Marley and the Wailers. Around the same time, Perry helped invent the spacey instrumental style known as dub reggae, which is now more influential in pop than ever. Critic Milo Miles catches up with two new Perry albums. Milo says they are his strongest in a long time.
Red light.
May I speak to the upsetter?
Red sight.
You know, he's
red
busy.
Right. I am happiness.
Maybe it's just because Lee Perry has his name on so many albums. But one odd thing about him is that there's little consensus on which are his most outstanding records. He wants to be elusive and to speak in riddles behind music that casts spells. My standard line on him is that he gave reggae a subconscious. Others say the simple explanation is that the man is more than a little mad, a notion he doesn't mind encouraging on occasion. I would argue that if he were as mad as he likes to pretend, his art would not be as sharp as it is. On the other hand, he's made a lot of dull records recently. He had worn out most of his own innovations in rhythm and arranging and was plainly looking for a collaborator to strike some sparks. He got a little mileage out of guys like Adrian Sherwood, but the natural partner for Perry had to be Mad Professor. Born Neil Fraser, Mad Professor ran his own studio like Perry did. And while he understood the harsh beats of raga and dancehall reggae, his forte was electronics, strange, mysterious sounds, and a pervasive mood of black empowerment. No. Perry and Mad Professor have done several collaborations, but the first one to click for more than two tracks in a row is Who Put the Voodoo Pun Reggae. As usual, Perry works as a supernatural braggart. On various tunes, he touts his spiritual insights, declares his solidarity with black pride, and extols his sexual ability. By today's standards, he's rather sweet about it, I should add. Perry often just chants in his dry tone, making up lyrics as he goes along, so coherence is never paramount. What you want is his presence, coupled with lively, modern arrangements. With the Mad Professor's slinky licks backing him up on Who Put the Voodoo Pun Reggae, Perry gets laughs and tingles simply by inviting a girl up to his messy apartment.
I hope you're not a proud girl. I hope you're not from the proud world. Really die in my messy sky, in my messy apartment. Hey, to manifest I messy. I'm messy, blessy. My apartment is so messy. So cause I'm messy. Smell so. You smell it, oh, you don't know why you smell it. Smelling, tasting, hearing and seeing.
Speaking of the professor, he has turned in a first-rate dub companion album called Dub Take the Voodoo Out of Reggae. These instrumental reimaginings of the Perry songs are not so much funhouse mirrors of them as complete transformations. Professor has a now uncommon affinity for soul sensuality, easy-going grooves, and beats that get your attention with caresses rather than slaps. Plus, he's got a puckish humor that matches Perry's. If you're a halfway serious reggae fan, the fun is not complete without both contributions from this very odd but very entertaining couple.
Milo Miles is a music critic in Cambridge. This is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Leah Rabin discusses the assassination of her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, former Prime Minister of Israel. Her new memoir describes finding friends among former enemies and enemies among countrymen.
Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Atlantic Monthly Press, publishers of Francisco Goldman's new novel, The Ordinary Seaman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While trying to cope with the assassination of her husband, Leah Rabin wrote a memoir about their lives together and his legacy. Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, was assassinated at a peace rally in November of 1995. He and Yasser Arafat shared a Nobel Peace Prize after signing a peace agreement. But now, under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the peace process seems to be falling apart, with street battles between Palestinians, Jewish settlers, and police. Leah Rabin is visiting the U.S. to talk about her memoir, Rabin, Our Life, His Legacy. I asked her if she's worried that the peace process is being derailed.
I'm worried. Look, unfortunately, you must understand how very personal I feel about the whole thing. They murdered my husband because of the Oslo Agreement. They felt they need to have him out of the way because Oslo is a crime. Oslo is terrible. Oslo is leading the wrong way. Everything about Oslo was wrong, was to be objected. And by God, the objection was there loud and clear by all those who objected wanted to have Yitzhak Rabin out of the political scene, out of the political way. It was either political or from the religious side part of our society. Them, I sort of tend to believe that they have an ideology that we should not compromise on the land. This land is holy and we shouldn't compromise it. Is when it comes to the political elements, some of them feel the same way. Others are, I think, just doing it for political reasons, wanted the power, were seeking the power, wanted to have Rabin out of the way. He was identified with Oslo, and when they murdered him, I think that was the end of it.
At your husband's funeral, you wouldn't shake Mr. Netanyahu's hand.
It's not true.
Okay,
that's wrong. It's a wrong conception. You know, there are those conceptions, those stigmas that sometimes stick to stories which were never true. I did shake his hand. I wasn't too happy to do it, but I did shake his hand. As much as my husband never said break the bones of the Palestinians in the Intifada. And that stuck to him for I don't know how long. And it was never true. That wasn't the kind of a language my husband would use.
Do you hold Mr. Netanyahu responsible in part for creating the climate behind the assassination?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do indeed. He was standing there in the demonstrations in the Zion Square in Jerusalem and other very, very big and loud and horrible demonstrations. Like, for instance, in one scene, you can see him leading a demonstration where they were carrying my husband's coffin. And this was 2 months before he was murdered. And on the coffin was written, Yitzhak Rabin, the murderer of Zionism. And this coffin was hanging above his head. So when he's being asked now, were you leading that demonstration? He says, yes, but I don't have eyes in my back and I never saw the coffin. Anyway, it was terrible. The climate was terrible. He was condemned. There were posters of Yitzhak Rabin with the keffiyeh of Yasser Arafat all over the country. I myself once became so enraged to look at it that I stopped the car, asked the driver to stop the car, and we both went and tore it off. It was all over the country. And every Friday afternoon, there were demonstrations in front of our house for hours, yelling, the traitor, the murderer, we shall oust you, we shall kill you. And on the last Friday, when I came home at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they were there and they said, we shall hang you in the square of the town, like they did to Mussolini and his mistress.
Did you think that they were really going to do that? Did you think your husband might actually be assassinated?
No, I did not think. I believe most of those who from the political leadership did not take in account that this horrible climate will eventually lead to a murder. They were frightened when it happened. But when you use such a language for months and months, and when you keep preaching that Yitzhak Rabin lost his mind and doesn't know where he's going and doesn't have any direction, is leading us to a national disaster, then you can take in account that there'll be someone there to think that he's fulfilling a holy mission by absolutely shooting him dead. And this is what happened.
Let me get to the day of the assassination. Your husband was unsure whether he should actually attend the peace rally at which he was assassinated. Why was he unsure about whether he should go?
I tell you, he was so unspoiled with a loud support. He was so missing this kind of people that would go out and demonstrate for him in support of him and Paris and what they were doing. There was no one on the street for them. So when they decided to have a big rally, he was doubtful. Will this rally really be big? Will it really have a big attendance? And if it doesn't, then it will be a contradictory to the purpose. Then the people will say, see here, they don't even come out to a rally. What really happened was that the turnout was so enormous, so overwhelming. There were over 200,000 people there on the square that night with flags and banners and singing and yelling, Rabin, Rabin, we love you, we want peace. All of a sudden, they were all there for him. So his hesitation were only based on his scare that the turnout is not going to be the way he wanted it to be. And when he saw the crowds, he was truly overwhelmed with joy and with, I think he was even in a way a little bit embarrassed with all this love declaration and all the declaration, here I am, Yitzhak Rabin, finally seeing it with my eyes that 200,000 people want this peace.
He had warnings beforehand about a possible assassination attempt. What were the warnings?
The warnings were, we'll kill you. And in one incident, there was someone who tried to get at him, an American Jew, who tried to get at him and hit him. But he was surrounded by security, and this guy was just picked up and thrown out. And then they tried to, they eliminated the, you know, the car, the Cadillac car has this front sign or whatever. So they took it off, and they said, if we can get to your car, that means we can get to you.
This is the emblem in the car that was his official car,
yeah,
for official, mm-hmm, ceremonies.
Yes, and they ripped it out.
Mm-hmm.
So there were all the warnings, all the writings on the wall, and when my husband was asked about it, he absolutely brushed it off. He said, no, I don't believe it. I don't believe a Jew will try to do that to me. Little did he know that this particular fellow had been planning it for a long time, had been there for rallies and, not rallies, all kinds of assemblies. There was an opening of an intersection in which my husband stood on a bridge together with the mayor of that place. And he tried it then. He admitted later he tried then, but he thought he doesn't stand good chances to achieve his goal. This time, I cannot try to explain to you what really happened. I myself don't have the answer, but he was there in the parking lot waiting for my husband to come down for 45 minutes.
What did you hear when your husband was shot?
I heard bullets. And I saw my husband falling to the ground. And, of course, this sight is in front of me and will stay there forever in front of me. I see him falling down and two or three securities over him. So what I thought was that they made him drop down, fall down, to protect him because there were the shots. And then I was told, right away I was told, the shots were not for real. Come quick. And they pulled me with force into a car, into the second car that was accompanying my husband's convoy. And I was driven out of town. And all the time I keep asking, where is my husband? And they said, we don't know. And I still wouldn't believe that really something happened to him because it was, I believed that the bullets were not for real.
How did you find out what really happened?
They took me to the headquarters of the Shabak, that's the Secret Service of Israel, and I'm sitting there getting worried more as the minutes go by and keep asking, why am I here? What's the story? What happened? And they say, we don't know. When we know, we will tell you. And they don't tell me anything. And I overhear them saying one to another, there were two injured, one severely and the other one slight. So I walked over to them and I said, I heard you saying two were injured, one severely and the other slight. I did not ask at that point who was the one. I understood it. One was the security and one the other one was my husband. This is what I should have understood. And I did not want to ask the question, who is the one that is severely and who is the one that is lightly wounded. I said, this minute, where's my husband? In the hospital. I said, this minute you're taking me over to the hospital. When we arrived to the hospital, looking into the eyes of the director who was waiting for me in the entrance of the hospital, I needed to see no more. I understood the severity, the gravity, the horror. And he was still kind of alive. They were working on him in the surgery room. They led me and the rest of the people who started streaming into the hospital to a nearby room. And we were sitting there and just, you know, waiting. And the minutes were going by. And he, the director of the hospital, came in and out. And there was a minute where they said, we still have a little hope because we managed to stabilize the blood pressure. But there really was no hope. And 5 minutes later, he opened the door and his eyes told us everything. He didn't need to say a word.
So you didn't get to see your husband again before
he
died?
Yes, I did. I asked. I said, I want to see him. I want to say goodbye. And I did.
When you found out that it was a Jew who had killed your husband, what was your reaction? Did you ever think that that was possible?
I don't think I was, you know, my husband was so much of an, forgive me, was so much of an authority that when he said he doesn't believe it and he doesn't think a Jew might do it to him, we all believed him. So did the security in a way. It was their task to protect him. But he was so absolutely assured that a Jew will not kill him. He couldn't imagine a situation like that. So I think we all were pretty assured that, no, there is no danger for his life. My daughter claims that she was worried. My sister-in-law says that she was quite worried. But I cannot say that I was really worried. I wasn't.
My guest is Leah Rabin. She's written a memoir about her husband, the late Yitzhak Rabin. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Leah Rabin is my guest, widow of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, who was assassinated. She's written a memoir about their life together called Rabin, Our Life, His Legacy. After the assassination, Yasser Arafat visited your house and paid a condolence call, as did King Hussein and Queen Noor of Jordan.
They came to the funeral.
They came to the funeral.
Yeah, they didn't come to they came to the house in Jerusalem before the funeral, but they came to the funeral, which Yasser Arafat felt he could not do, and therefore, 2 or 3 days later, in disguise, he came to our house in Tel Aviv, and this was very, very, very amazing, among so many other things that happened. I mean, 87 leaders of state of world of the world came to the funeral. Yasser Arafat coming into my living room with his aides, all these things, and the thousands and thousands and thousands that were crying for him and lighting candles and being there day and night at his graveside in the spot where he was murdered. I mean, it was the whole country, I think, held his breath for 7 days and stopped. It was just a horrible, horrible shock and a horrible crisis. And I thought that out of this, something very wonderful will happen, that this murder must have had a meaning, that this victim is will have a reason. And I thought that by now we'll see this enormous support for peace, that Mr. Peres will realize day and night that he's not alone, that they didn't leave him alone, and we will from here go to the victory of the election and continue the peace process that my husband and Mr. Peres started together or were working on together. All this did not happen, and it was a terrible, terrible, terrible moment for us.
I'd like to get back to Yasser Arafat's
yes,
condolence
visit.
Call. Yeah. What kind of disguise was he wearing?
He was wearing a hat, you know, a real hat, and a coat, an overcoat, and glasses. So when you met him on the street, you wouldn't know it's him. No way. And then he took off the hat, and he was sitting there without a kaffi and without a hat. And this is for the first time that we saw him like that. And he was extremely warm and extremely friendly. And he kissed us all and hugged us all. And I mean, it became so amazingly natural that here Yasser Arafat is sitting in our living room. Except that you were wondering, and where is Yitzhak?
Are you still in contact with Yasser Arafat or with his wife?
Yes, I am in contact. He calls me up on certain occasions, on special occasions. For instance, he called for the Jewish New Year to say Shana Tova. When he heard that my son got married, he called to congratulate us and sent a glorious gift to my new daughter-in-law. So we are in very, very friendly relations. So we are with His Majesty King Hussein and Queen Noor. And may I tell you a very amazing phenomena that I hit all the time. I think that after my husband's murder, I remained like a symbol for every member of the Arab world. And wherever I go, whether it's on the street or in the lobby of a hotel, people would come over, Mrs. Rabin, may I shake your hand? I am from Qatar. I am from Dubai. I'm from Saudi Arabia. And all I ever sense is this enormous respect for what we all lost. I say, the murder of my husband disabled me, made me a disabled person, but I think, unfortunately, it disabled our nation and disabled the area. He is so missed.
Do you feel like you're on better terms now with Yasser Arafat than you are with the new Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu?
I have no relations with Mr. Netanyahu, so there is no comparison. I cannot say if my relationship with Mr. Netanyahu are good or bad. There are none.
I guess that says something right there.
Yeah. If you asked me at the beginning if I hold him responsible, and in many ways I do, then why do you think I should have relationship with him now? He never expressed remorse. He never went to the grave to ask for pardon. He could have done that. It would have, I think, changed the mood somehow or other if he would go to the graveside and said, Yitzhak Rabin, I admit we had made a mistake. Will you forgive us? But he didn't.
In your memoir, you say that your husband was often described as a soldier who late in life became a man of peace. But you consider that to be an incorrect assessment.
Absolutely incorrect, because he was a military man for 27 years who believed that only if we really maintain a very strong military force can we then aspire for peace. His aspirations were truly and honestly for peace. He never stopped for one day believing that, if we are strong enough, that day will come. If we prove time and again that we are indestructible, which the Arabs wouldn't believe. I mean, a small community, starting with 600,000, and such as I described it, such a poor armament and such inferior beginning conditions, and emerged into one of the strongest armies, certainly in the area and maybe in the whole world. After the Six-Day War, which was this very, very amazing victory, in which we again proved that though attacked by three Arab neighboring countries, we not only survived, we had this enormous victory. So from then on, he said, okay, I think I've done my share for the Israeli military force. Now I want to go to Washington, because Washington will be the only place that we can hope to get a support for the cause of peace, and this is where I want to be. And this is where we went.
My guest is Leah Rabin. She's written a memoir about her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, the assassinated Prime Minister of Israel. This is Fresh Air. This week, public radio stations across the country are fundraising, so we're taking a break to let you know how important your pledge is. We couldn't continue to bring you the personal reflections of world leaders, religious leaders, writers, musicians, artists, without your support. Without your pledge, there would be no Fresh Air. In fact, there'd be no public radio. Thank you for your support. My guest is Leah Rabin. She's written a memoir about her husband, Yitzhak Rabin, the assassinated Israeli prime minister. The mother of the convicted assassin is campaigning for forgiveness. And in fact, she's even saying that the assassination may have been part of a conspiracy to boost support for your husband, the idea being that this was supposed to be an attempted assassination, not a completed assassination. And
what does that mean?
And he would be rescued from the assassination, but his endangerment would boost his support. Isn't this what she's saying?
That this, you know, just what? Like
a, yes.
I tell you something. I'm not interested in what she's saying. I really am not. She never apologized. She's here. She's there to defend her son and what he was doing. I don't see that he deserves defense. I don't see that he deserved to have participated in our election. He does not be related to us, a human being. Unfortunately, we don't have death penalty, or else we didn't have to deal with him at all any longer. He murdered my husband. He admitted it. And what is she trying to do? What is she trying to achieve? He admitted it. He never expressed remorse, nor did she. So I'm not interested to hear what she says. And I don't believe in the story of the conspiracy at all, one bit.
Have any of the verbal attacks that were directed against your husband in the last part of his life, are any of those attacks now getting directed at you?
No. No, they're not. I'm no political threat for them. And I'm not conducting a peace process. So the answer is no. And I don't see and don't hear much animosity at all. I hear an enormous support. I hear people express their sorrow about having lost Yitzhak. They come over to me to shake my hand in Israel and wherever I go abroad. We are sorry about the loss of your husband. We admire the man. He was our hope. And you know, when President Clinton had said, Shalom Chaver, you know about that. Shalom Chaver, goodbye friend. And now there is a sticker that says, Chaver Ata Chaser, which means friend, we miss you. And there's a sticker on many, many, many cars. And people come over to me recently, for instance, a couple which I met in London, on the street, strangers, come over and say, we miss him more day by day.
I have a question about the handshake between your husband and Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn after the signing of the peace agreement. Did your husband go with the intention of shaking Yasser Arafat's hand? Did he know he was going to do that?
He wanted to be in Washington. He wanted to be there together with Yasser Arafat. He could have imagined that there isn't any other way to express a desire of reconciliation but by a handshake. And if for a moment he looked uncomfortable, it is due to the fact, A, that he had said for a long time that he will never shake the hand of this man, which now he's doing. And B, let me tell you that if it wasn't in front of the whole world, he may not have this expression on his face. It was because, he said, now the whole world is watching me doing something I said I never will. So this was the discomfort he sensed for a moment. At the same time, I, who, as his wife, and was very close to all the considerations and all the plannings, etc., I know for sure how much he wanted to be there and how he understood the full meaning of these two people being there for the moment of reconciliation. The two leaders of two societies who have been in conflict, in a very bitter conflict, for over 100 years. And here is this dramatic moment of the handshake, the symbol of, from now on, we want to put an end to our conflict. We want from here to go on to a peaceful resolution.
Leah Rabin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Leah Rabin's memoir is called Rabin, Our Life, His Legacy. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Fred Snyder, Bob Purdick, Bob Alls, Al Banks, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Regina O'Toole is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.